Chip Doc.
Welcome back to Therapy Insiders. Dr. Gene Chirakabad is always here with Dr. Joe Palmer. Joe and I have been on a little bit of a hiatus. Had a lot of work-related, life-related events, but we are back, and we got some pretty exciting episodes lined up for you guys.
Pretty excited, Gene.
Joe, if you're excited, I'm sure everyone else is excited. So we're gonna get started today with probably or arguably the most common pathology or injury that I treat. I'm sure you're the same, Joe, and I think most clinicians can say this, is low back pain. Low back pain encompasses various diagnoses, and we're going to discuss a few of the most common ones that we see. So, Joe, let's start out with one of the more simpler diagnoses, if you can say that, is a segmental dysfunction. So you want to run through some of the common things, in the subjective report that you would see with a segmental dysfunctions that would make you think that it is what it is?
Well, first, let's make the point that you're probably not getting a diagnosis with a segmental dysfunction. That's probably a great indicator that you're actually dealing with a segmental dysfunction, is that they're not coming in with a diagnosis. It is a joint hypo, or in some cases a hypermobility, that is not seen on x-rays. It's not seen on MRIs, and so is often overlooked as maybe insignificant from the rest of the medical team.
That's a good point. I actually do see a diagnosis in this, and it's a low back pain diagnosis. So it's a diagnosis that is not a diagnosis, because low back pain, to be honest, is not a diagnosis, just like bad posture is not a diagnosis. So you're absolutely correct. They'll get the MRI, they'll get their x-rays, and they're all essentially negative. So then it's up to us to decipher what the heck really is going on.
And most of the time you're looking at moderate pain. It has a lot to do with position and movement. It is mechanical in nature and typically localized. So you're not getting a lot of radiating symptoms. Not saying that you can't, just saying that typically it's more local.
That's a good point. So when you do get some radiating symptoms or some referral pains, where do you typically see those referral pains for a typical pure segmental dysfunction?
I would say that for a pure segmental dysfunction, you're getting those. They're not going very far distally, I guess, is the best way to describe it. They're in the dermatomal or segmental distribution pattern of that joint, if that's what you're looking for there, Gene.
Right, exactly. So when you do your screen, when you do your lower quarter screen and you're testing your myotomes, generally you'll find a difference in strength. Maybe it might be slight, it might be, you know, 4+, but you can find something in that dermatome. So if the issue is, let's say, L5 left facet is hypermobile and you have a dysfunction at that area, chances are, if you're testing, you know, if you're doing the great toe or whatever you use for your L5 myotome, you'll find whether it's just the endurance isn't there or something is going on or that makes you think that is segmental in nature. But generally, neurological signs will not be present. So paresthesias, all those reflexes, you might have a little briskness in the reflex, but generally, you won't have paresthesias along with just a segmental dysfunction or hypomobility. You mentioned movement. Usually, with the segmental dysfunction, it's one motion or the other that is limited. So usually, not every single motion is limited. So if they have a flexion restriction, the patient will not like flexion. So if it's flexion on the left, they also most likely will not like right side bending because that creates a flexion moment. Anything else, Joe?
You're going to find a jammed end field. The end field is going to be jammed, and that's essential to the definition hypomobile segmental dysfunction.
Jammed, or you might find hard capsular, depending on what the restriction is. So the point that Joe brings up is palpation after your initial screen, range of motion, and subjective becomes critical. So you have to be very precise with your joint glides, your pivums and pavums, and understanding what each end feel really means, because jammed and hard are very different things. You're going to do very, very different techniques. I know when I train students, that's one of the biggest things that we, or that I harp on, is because that'll separate you from a mediocre to a really good physical therapist, at least in the manual therapy world, is if you understand what the heck's going on underneath your fingers.
No substitute for it.
There really isn't. All right, so we kind of went through a very common presentation of a hypomobility patient. It's one of those patients that comes in, says, either I just woke up and it's been really bothering me. I took some NSAIDs, felt a little bit better, but it's still there. It's been going on for kind of 2 weeks. Or it's one of those patients that will come into your clinic with a 20-year history of low back pain that is episodic in nature. It comes and goes, it goes, and then it comes back, you know, years later or months later. And that also fits in the same type of category. If they come into you when they said that it just started 2 weeks ago, you can go ahead and do a little dance inside your head, because your prognosis is a lot greater to get them up and running than somebody that comes in 20 years later, because they have 20 years of compensations built up. So I don't know about you, Joe, but I like to do a nice little dance inside my head when that happens.
Well, important to ask the right questions. It's good that you bring up the episodic nature of the pain, because, you know, sometimes these episodes, they happen and then reoccur so frequently that, you know, if you just ask, well, how long has pain been going on, you may get somebody that says, you know, 20 years. But in reality, you know, the question is, how long has this episode been going on?
Exactly. So also along the segmental dysfunction term or diagnosis, if you go a little distal, it's the SI joint. Now, there's numbers all over the place about how commonly sacroiliac joint pain is present or is involved with low back pain. And me personally, this is me talking my experience and my patient load. By the time patients come in to see me with low back pain, the SI joint is involved at the minimum 80% of the time. Now, whether it's the driving force or the compensation, that I can't say. But by that time there is pain, it's involved more times than not. So what do you do for the SI joint, Joe? And what do you see with the SI joint dysfunction?
Well, I'm gonna do all of my special tests at the SI joint in standing first. I'm gonna look at their feet and assess for leg length, and then I'm gonna have them lay down. I'm gonna feel the joint feel through the SI joint. I'm gonna do a squish test, and I want to make sure that what I'm looking at is a true SI joint dysfunction. But what I think what you are saying is that regardless of what is the causal factor of the pain that they're having, when you are looking at treating their pain, you don't look to just treat that area. You're going to look above and below, and if there is dysfunctional movement at the SI joint and you don't treat it as part of your treatment for low back pain, you're asking for recurrence. I really think that, you know, you're doing the patient a disservice if you kind of make believe the SI joint is not there.
Absolutely. I mean, it's like running into a burning building with the fire on the first floor, you know, but the first three floors are on fire, and you go, well, the fire started on the third floor, so I'm just going to put that fire out, and I'm sure it'll be okay after that. It just doesn't work that way. So you gotta put it all out if it's all relevant and it's all happening.
Right.
So the SI joint, you said you glide the joints. I do the same thing. You put them in supine first. You know, the SI joint where the sacrum and the inner iliac crest come together, it's a bit of an angle, right? They are not straight up and down. So when I do my glides, they're a bit of an oblique glide. So the squish test, you said. So I do a bit of a glide with that. I would glide the ASIS on the side that I'm testing into a flexion position, which is slightly superior and lateral, while blocking the contralateral and omnet, and then vice versa. You stabilize the contralateral and omnet in the superolateral position and glide the involved and omnet inframedial. And that really stresses the SI joint, and you can really pick up that end field that we were discussing earlier. And then flip them over and do the same thing, gliding the actual sacrum. So you can test the sacrum into flexion and extension. Now, these are purely biomechanical glides. This is taking out all the ERSs, FRSs, right sacral torsions, backward sacral torsions. Talking strictly biomechanical glides, which to me is a simpler approach to doing it. Do you do the backward sacral torsions, or do you do just biomechanical?
I do the biomechanical glides. I'll also do a contralateral squish test with a direct AP force through the ASIS, and I will feel for any movement in the contralateral ASIS into my hand. So if you can envision that, then what I'm actually trying to do is to see if the contralateral ASIS is jammed or stuck, because you would expect some amount of dissipation in your force through one ASIS to the other, through the SI joint itself, unless it's not moving at all, in which case it would be jammed.
Now, as always, if you guys are visual learners and we're just throwing a lot of words at you, feel free to let us know. And again, we'd be more than happy to answer emails, send some pictures, or post some videos on YouTube. And in that regard, thank you for the comments and the continual subscriptions, even though we haven't made a regular podcast in a little bit. So it's been great to see you guys still listening and interested in the material. We should also mention the SI joint is one of the few joints that is not directly controlled by muscles. So it's based on the congruency of that joint, the rigid sacrum and the rigid innominate. So what happens is we have two terms that we should probably discuss just for a short time, is form closure and force closure, right? If the SI joint is just jammed up like any other joint, it's more times than not a pretty easy fix, because once that mechanical input is corrected, the nervous system is pretty good at reducing whatever S1, S2 issues have been going on because of the SI joint problems, and whatever other compensations you can start working on without that input being disturbed. But if the actual form closure is disrupted, it becomes a little bit more problematic. So form closure is if the congruency is disturbed, meaning if those rigid edges become a little bit smoother, then your stability goes out the window. So form closure is that congruency, and force closure is the muscles in the pelvis really working hard to create stability. So if you have a form closure issue, you have an uphill climb to get that SI joint stabilized versus force closure.
And how do you handle those, Gene?
The force closure, again, is easier. It's figuring out why those muscles are inefficient at stabilizing the pelvis. And a lot of times it's looking up proximally at the lumbar spine. So if there's an issue at L4, L5, you're going to have problems with the gluteal muscles, or you're going to have facilitations with the other pelvic muscles or hip external rotators. If you go down lower to L5, S1 as well. If you fix those proximal issues and then you do your hip abductor strengthening, or more precisely making them more efficient, then the force closure a lot of times is restored, with also some lumbar stability that we'll get into, and with other diagnoses. But if it's a form closure issue, that becomes a problem. What I like to do is, if I suspect a form closure issue, I have the patient lying down supine and I have them do an active straight leg raise test. If they do that active straight leg raise test and they have pain, and then I apply medial pressure at their pelvic crest or the iliac crest, so I kind of squish their pelvis together, and then I have them raise that leg up again. So what I'm essentially doing is creating form closure externally. And they raise that leg up again, and that pain dissipates. I know that it's most likely a form closure issue. And that becomes, it becomes tough. You have to get creative. You can try, you know, a lot of times I'll wrap a towel or sheet around their pelvis really tight and do a lot of their rehab in that position. You know, SI joint belts become handy. But then you're doing the best you can to create the best possible force closure that you can for them. But like I said, a lot of times that's an uphill battle. And I know there's some new surgeries out there that you could probably talk about, Joe.
Yeah, well, you definitely aren't doing a dance when you find that one.
Definitely not doing a dance. It's
tell you that.
Yeah, it's putting your head down, shaking it, and having a nice talk with your patients, telling them what the heck's going on.
Yeah, so, and, you know, I had a patient recently that I was working with on a form closure issue, and, you know, going through and doing some of the research out there to try to figure out what their best option was.
What'd you find?
We've had pretty good success with prolotherapy injections, essentially trying to bring healing factors and scar down that area to I guess in essence create that form closure that they lack. I feel that some of the, you know, when you're dealing with a form closure issue, you can give them all the core stability stuff that you want, and you can address force, you know, closure, but I don't think it's enough to compensate. I really haven't found it to be the case where I'm able to, through exercise, stabilize a form closure problem.
I agree. It's very difficult, and you do your best to put out any fires that they have, but there's just not a ton of good outcomes with form closure issues. So I'm hoping prolotherapy can help. I haven't seen too much about it in terms of patients, but I know you've seen more than I in terms of that surgery.
Yeah, and just so we're not confusing people, it really is it's a series of outpatient injections. So I mean, I know it's still a procedure, but yeah, you know, throw around the S word there, and you know, it is pretty less invasive than a open surgery procedure, you know.
Right. Well, you know, the old saying is the only minor surgery not done to you. So
yeah,
it might be minor.
It's an excellent point.
But it like anything else in the medical world, you weigh your pros and cons. You have good discussion with your clinical providers. And, you know, if you've been living with a lot of pain and if you have a ton of form closure issues, this might be a solid option to at least look into. All right. So we have SI joint problems. And like I said, if you guys want to know more, you want to know more about our techniques and what we look for, we just kind of gave you a general rundown because we could probably spend a whole podcast series on just the SI joint very easily. So let's move on to another very, very common diagnosis, and that is a HNP, or herniated disc, or a bulging disc, or anything else disc-related that people come in with. So most common thing that you would see, Joe, that as the patient's sitting there giving you subjective, what are some of the things that scream to you that this is most likely a disc issue, aside from that piece of paper they hand you that says HNP?
Right, and I think the most common thing is that they're going to demonstrate high irritability. They are going to have obligate restrictions. They're not going to be able to work through these pains. Okay, this is a very intense and sharp kind of a pain that they're describing. Now, as I go through the presentation in my head, you're going to have people that come in with an MRI that says I have bulging disc or bulging, you know, 4.5, 5S1, and they're not going to present with that sharpness. That's kind of a cue to me that, well, is this their pain generator? I mean, it could be, but if it didn't just happen, then, you know, it's not something that it's not acute. Maybe it is more of a chronic type disc dysfunction that they have, or, you know, maybe there is something else causing their pain. So, you know, those are the kind of things that are going through my head, because, you know, MRIs, I think we've talked about it. Patients want them because they want to know what's wrong, and they want to be able to say, this is what's causing my pain, but not always entirely helpful.
Sure. I mean, you're talking about a static snapshot of a dynamic issue in a lot of instances, but there's variances of degrees of disc problems, you know, going from a slight bulge to sequestration. So it all depends. And I've seen that spectrum. I've seen a 19-year-old female that landed on her butt snowboarding, saw a chiropractor, but to be fair, she could have seen a physical therapist. She could have seen anyone. But she just happened to get her SI joint manipulated, which I'm sure at the time was jammed up. But also at that time she had a disc problem and ended up being sequestered. So by the time she came to me, because she was a family friend, and I was asked if I could just take a look at her. So I looked at her, and she had pure nonstop paresthesias, neurological unilateral leg problems. You know, it was going all the way down to her foot. She could barely feel her foot. It was consistently burning, waking her up at night. Her toes were numb most of the time. Pain-wise, it varied. You know, after I treated her, her low back pain actually subsided, just because I think it was a lot of compensation, like you're saying. And we talked about this in our myth episode, is disc herniations in themselves are not painful. Disc material is not highly innervated structures. It's when that acute episode happens and there's inflammation and it pushes against the nerve ending, or if it just leaks to the point and it sequesters, or it just the material leaks or it protrudes into the nerve endings whenever they move and that area gets irritated, then it's painful. But a disc herniation in itself will not generally be painful.
That nucleus is toxic to the nerves.
It is toxic. It's leaking. So that case that I was telling you about, that snowboarding girl, she ended up having surgery, and she texted me a picture, and it looked like a, you know, when you, for lack of a better term, it looked like a bloody booger. It was not something that you'd want swimming around near your spinal cord. But she, you know, she had a microdiscectomy, and she bounced back, and she's good to go. And bless her little heart, she's still snowboarding.
Yeah, I'm going to stick with my skis.
I'm going to stick with my beach. So neither one of those are good for me. Or even golf, you know. I'm okay with golf. All right, so to sum up, you'll see range of motion, you'll have pain limitations in pretty much most directions, unlike the segmental dysfunction, which you would see one impairment usually, whether flexion or extension. You're not going to see overall most motions lost, whereas in a disc herniation, aside from a little bulge, you're going to see most motions limited in some directions, with two or three being really, really painful and irritated, depending on which direction that disc is being squished.
Straight leg raise. Let's talk about, while you're talking about direction, mm-hmm. Let's talk to all the McKenzie therapists. What are you seeing as far as the role in extension based exercises for probable disc herniations?
So my problem with McKenzie or any of those types of techniques is when your only tool is a hammer, everything really looks like a nail, and it doesn't work that way. You know, if that disc herniation is slightly anterior, and then you're doing it every time you're doing extensions, you're going to slide it anterior, vice versa, if it's posterior and you're pinching it when you're doing extensions. But then again, it depends on where that disc herniation is, because you might do it and might feel great, or you might do it and might not feel great. And that same patient might come in 3 days later, have slight irritation, some inflammation in there. That inflammation is going to push things around. They'll do extension, and all of a sudden extension hurts. So when you put a blanket technique on every single disc herniation, to me, you're doing the patient disservice. Does it have its uses? Sure. There's places where it becomes really useful. But you can't just blindly say, okay, you have a disc herniation, we're going to do McKenzie stuff.
Right. I agree with that. I will trial it on my patients, and if they have a positive response to it, I have no problems using it. But you're right. You don't want to throw that blanket.
I do not want to throw that blanket. I generally don't throw things at patients. Well, I take that back. I'll throw things at them all the time.
Go ahead. You were talking about straight leg raise. Sorry about that.
Straight leg raise. No, you got me off on a tangent. Now I'm talking about throwing things at patients. Straight leg raise. Generally, you'll see a positive straight leg raise, generally below 60 degrees. A lot of times if it's sequestered or if it's really protruding out, you can do a straight leg raise and the contralateral side will hurt. Meaning if their pain's usually on the left side, or if it's pinching off the left nerve endings and you raise their right leg up, it's going to elicit pain. So when you do that, you know you have a pretty significant issue. But the big, big, big thing when you have a disc herniation and it's a severe one, like Joe said, is that obligate functional loss, meaning they cannot control their compensations, and you will see a entalgia gate pattern. You will see compensations beginning immediately. So assessing them functionally, meaning in gait, is critical. And I can't even put into words how often I see this missed. And, you know, people get exercises, people do manual therapy. It doesn't matter. If you don't fix their gait compensation, they will never improve, and their compensations will stick with them until they finally find a clinician that can assess that. What about you, Joe? Do you take a look at them walking and see how they actually look functionally?
No, absolutely. I mean, not only is it a huge clue to what's going on, but, you know, and this is the analogy that I give, you know, you have to treat that herniation, you have to treat your injury kind of like a bruise, and you have to not aggravate it continually. You have to not use those compensations in order to let it heal. You don't want to prolong your recovery by altering your patterns and possibly putting stress in other places.
Absolutely, absolutely. So if you suspect or if a patient's been diagnosed with an HNP, do them a favor, take off their shoes and watch them walk. And not only the most common things, you know, we talked about functional leg discrepancy a little bit in our previous podcast. You're looking at shoulders and you're watching the head. If their shoulder drops, they drop and they have a shorter lower extremity chain on that side, versus if their head vaults or goes up, that the side that it goes up on is a little bit longer. So then it's your job as a clinician is to figure out where that compensation happened to create that functional leg length discrepancy. Again, if you have more questions, feel free to let us know, because we can, again, spend a whole hour just talking about functional leg length stuff. So, moving along, you got me thinking about the McKenzie stuff and the extension. Did you want to say something else about that?
Well, yeah. Well, talk a little bit about what age range you're really expecting to see most of your herniations in. Is there one that you particularly, you know, pay attention to more than another?
Yeah, I generally, most herniations kind of happen in that weekend warrior type of age set. So I usually see them in the 30 to 50 range. It's, again, a pretty big range, but majority of my patients are on the younger side that have the disc herniations. One of the reasons for that as well is, you know, most of us will have some kind of disc bulges, you know, that we live with asymptomatically, and I think the statistic is around 70%. But also as you get older, the innervation and the sensation internally deadens a little bit. So you don't really, you're not bothered by it as much. So usually when you're in your 30s, 40s, or even mid to late 20s, when you get that disc herniation, it becomes really problematic. But also that's the age where you doing more activities and a little bit more prone to these types of injuries. What about you?
I just wanted to make that point that, you know, in your 60s, 65 plus kind of patient, you're not likely to see it. So, you know, you should make sure that you're looking for the right things, you know, and I feel like in that kind of a patient, you're much more likely to see maybe another problem that we are going to talk about tonight.
There is a group of people that you really, really shouldn't do extension-based things with unless you're talking about T-spine. So if somebody has stenosis, Joe, you're doing any extension stuff with them?
They're not letting me do any extension stuff with them. What are you kidding?
tell me why, aside from the fact that they might hit you.
Yeah, because I'm gonna flare them up because they're in pain and stenosis. You know, that's the narrowing of your foramen and in that extended position. You're looking at making that space even smaller. So, you know, it doesn't really matter. To me, you know, what's causing the stenosis, you know, that's not the issue. The issue is that when they get up into that, an extended position, you are closing down what little, opening they have left.
Yeah, absolutely. So, and we have two types. We have central and we have lateral stenosis. Essentially the same thing, except central, you can make a case is a bit more serious because it's that bilateral arthritic buildup inside that foramen, and lateral stenosis is just left or right, and it kind of just irritates the nerve endings unilaterally. But like you said, you know, that extension closes it down, and you have about 8 millimeters of space to play with before the spinal cord gets touched and irritated, which I can confidently say for every single clinician is something you do not want to do. So if you get an MRI and you see 4 millimeters, 6 millimeters, 7 millimeters, you know, once it gets close to the 8 millimeter range, your room for error with extension gets less and less. But the number one, the hallmark thing that you will hear with all these patients, and Joe, you already alluded to this, is stiffness. They will be stiff most of the time. Pain can be moderate. Sometimes it can be severe. But these are the people that are kind of walking around in that really kyphotic, almost question mark type pose. And they do not want to extend. They love their flexion. They love their lumbar kyphosis. And they're just stiff all over.
You know, and the gait is a huge thing to look for at these people. Posture, because you're right, they're going to find that position of comfort. You know, more often than not, they're going to have some kind of decreased walking tolerance because they don't want to be standing for that long. And I tell you, you know, the grocery cart sign is a pretty positive test, I think, for these people. You ask them when they walk the best, and most of them will tell you, well, I walk the best when I'm doing my grocery shopping and pushing the grocery cart, because they all lean forward onto that grocery cart, and that's a huge sense of relief for them.
Absolutely, and I think one big point that I hope we can drive through is you're not really treating stenosis, right? You're not getting into their spine. You're not shaving off that foramen. What you're going to be treating is the compensations they built up. When they're constantly in that lumbar kyphotic position and that flex position, their paraspinals, lumbar paraspinals, thoracic paraspinals are consistently in a state of stretch. And that is not a good feeling. We tried walking around, flexing forward and walking around like that all day long. you're going to be sore as heck. So you're going to be fixing that a lot. Again, they'll have their lumbopelvic, lumbosacral issues. You're going to clean that up. Then you're going to do your best to stabilize the heck out of that spine so there is as little irritation as possible on the spine and the vertebrae and the facets.
And you want to make sure you set your goals reasonably. I mean, it may not be reasonable for you to say, well, I need you to stand upright. You know, they're not going to be military posture anymore.
Nor should they be because of what they have.
Right. But can you find a middle ground that enables them to get a little bit more paraspinal activation to aid in stability without flaring them up? I mean, that's kind of the way I look at it.
Absolutely. It's, again, the pain in this instance a lot of times is from the compensation and not so much from the actual stenosis. They'll have stiffness. They'll have some lower extremity aches and pains. They'll have occasional referral when their movement irritates that nerve ending. But more times than not, their pain will be coming from compensation. So your job is to figure out where that compensation is coming from. Now, one thing that I should note in the differential diagnosis is if somebody's coming to you that's younger in age, because stenosis, you're usually going to be talking your 50-year-olds plus. But if somebody's coming to you younger in age, let's say 25 to 50, and they have similar stiffness, very restricted, almost stenotic in nature, I would start thinking about ankylosing spondylosis because that can present very similarly to a central or lateral stenosis in a younger population. Those guys will come in very, very stiff. And the hallmark test for us in terms of PT world is how much motion they have in their rib cage. So you want to take a tape measure, put it around their chest, have them take a deep breath and see what you get. Because if it is ankylosing spondylosis, their rib cage is barely going to move.
That's a good point. Probably one that not many people are checking out. So definitely one to keep on your radar so that you don't miss it.
Keep it in your back pocket. And all right, let's finish out with the last bit. And this kind of goes under segmental dysfunction. But the reason we saved it for last is because it's kind of a bear. And it's going to take a lot longer, and it's going to take a lot of communication and education of the patient. And that is the hypermobility or the instability. And you can classify that under segmental dysfunction. This also incorporates your spondylitic changes, spondylolisthesis, spondylolysis. All those are essentially instabilities. Now, if you have somebody that comes with a spondylolisthesis grade 1 or 2, you can still help them out. But if they're coming in with higher grade spondylolisthesis, that is pretty tough. Or if you suspect a higher grade spondylolisthesis in your younger athletes, this is, again, it's going to happen generally more with females. But if you are suspecting this problem, have it checked out. Better safe than sorry. But let's talk about some of the things you'll see with instabilities, some of the things you'll see with spondylolisthesis. You have a couple types of spondylolisthesis. We're not going to go into great detail the difference between degenerative and isthmic. But essentially, you'll have either unilateral or bilateral pain in the back. They'll have a lot of times what I see is this horizontal pain across the back. It just goes straight across at a segmental level. So let's say they have an L5-S1 spondylolisthesis or spondylosis or spondylysis. It'll go just straight across that L5 area when they're extending. And more times than not, and this goes for instability as well, when you have them flex, when their trunk flexes, and you have them return. It's that returning from flexion to extension, and you see them doing their crawling up on their thighs. And more times than not, when I see that, it's instability pathway for me. What about you, Joe?
Yeah, because they're not able to control that segment wherever it may be as they activate to return into the extension. You know, you're nothing else really fits that pattern. I guess that's the simplest way to put it.
Exactly. So if you have somebody younger that is having a lot of this pain and they have bilateral lower extremity symptoms, lower leg symptoms, a couple things I've also seen is cramping. They get a lot of cramping in their legs, bilateral legs. So if you hear a lot of cramping complaints from younger athletes, high school athletes, college athletes, you have this horizontal pain across their back, start thinking instability and some kind of spondylitic change. So what to do? What do you do with these people? It's stability training. It's getting them in the position to functionally be able to support their spine while doing whatever activity they need to do. So let's do a fairly quick rundown on some of the things you do, Joe, for spinal stability when patients have instabilities or spondylitic changes.
Just speaking in generalities, I'm going to start them in a pelvic neutral position, and I'm going to support them in a pelvic neutral position until they can prove that they can keep a pelvic neutral position in an unsupported environment. So basically, what I'm trying to say is I'm going to do core exercises with them laying on a mat, either supine or prone, and I'm going to try to strengthen until they can prove to me that they can maintain pelvic neutral while doing maybe an alternating arm, leg type exercise in quadruped. And then, you know, I'm going to continue to progress their unsupported activities to improve their core that way.
Right. That's definitely a pretty good start. I think the two most common research areas for lumbopelvic stability is on the local versus global muscle stabilizers. And the two big local ones are the transversus abdominis and the multifidi muscles. So me personally, and I fall into that camp where the transversus abdominis is a reflexive muscle, meaning that muscle should turn on to stabilize before you even do the activity when you're just thinking about doing it. So a lot of the bracing exercises, I'm not a huge fan of. I do it sometimes just in the early phases so patients can get that awareness of their bodies and what's going on. Multifidi training, I definitely do a heavy amount on, is trying to get their multifidi, segmental multifidi to fire.
I'll say one thing on that is, you know, whether you're actually, because I agree with you, you're not firing those muscles. You're not activating those muscles every time you move or use them. You're right. They are reflexive. But if they're not being used because of pain inhibition or what have you, then just the act of getting them to fire again can be immensely beneficial.
Absolutely. I definitely agree with that point. It's important for the patients to know, at least have strategies, that it might not be the best thing forever to, you know, bring your belly button back towards the spine or whatever cue you use while they're playing sports, but it can be pretty useful for them just as a pain relieving tool, that when their back is acting up, they can, and they know how to do this and get a little quick stability into their spine and take some stress off. But also remember the innervation of the abdominals. You're talking lower thoracic spine. So especially in rotational sport athletes, that can be a big problem for them. So make sure you assess the thoracic spine as well. And we've alluded to this before, is you need to look above and below the problem to make sure there's not other things compensating to it. So a lot of my training I do for stability is involves a little bit of what Joe was talking about on the mat. But there's also a heavy dose of PNF. I do a lot of pelvic PNF. I do a lot of trunk PNF, getting rotational patterns, because torsional stress is one of the biggest and most stressful things the spine, especially the lumbar spine, has to deal with. So if you can start retraining those diagonal patterns for the patient, they're going to be a lot more efficient at stabilizing in those rotational torsional stresses. But I also do a lot of immobility with it, meaning they'll do a lot of upper extremity motions while stabilizing the trunk, right? So the purest definition of stability is creating motion somewhere and not letting motion happen somewhere else. And when you're doing that, you can really create and establish stability. But don't forget about the pelvis. Don't forget about your glute meds. Don't forget about hip extension. All those are critical in creating a environment of healing for the lumbar spine. And I'm sure you hit the pelvis and the glutes as well, don't you, Joe?
Yes. Yeah, you can't forget about them. Where do you find yourself with muscle stim? Like it? Hate it?
Neuromuscular stim, absolutely. Every single patient that has instability or even low back pain, because you'll have pain inhibition early on in the treatments, they all get neuromuscular stim on the segment that hurts. So if I know that L4, L5 is involved, I'm going to put the stem right at L4, L5, because remember, multifidi are segmental muscles. And I'm having them do, before I even do all that, you know, that they're taught how to do multifidi contractions. Again, whether you believe or don't that you can feel multifidi activating, that's a personal thing. I personally believe that you can if you have good enough palpatory skills. And we work through it, kind of what you're talking about with the transversus, so they know what that activation is. We do the same thing with multifidi. So I'll have them do, you know, I usually do 10 seconds on, 10 seconds off. On time, they'll do their multifidi contraction, and off time, they'll relax, because that NMES, that neuromuscular stim, is very, very good at activating those segmental multifidi. What about you?
Oh, yeah. I absolutely like to do it. Feel like it really can give that patient a little bit of an edge, especially early on.
Right. And also, depending on what state you're in, dry needling is effective for myofascial type of pain. Again, the compensation type stuff, it's pretty good with instabilities, because instabilities, you got to be in for the long haul. You have to explain to the patients, this is not a quick fix. You might feel better. You might wake up one day and feel great. Then you might wake up 2 days later and be pretty painful. And that's the whole, you know, that's what you see with instabilities, ups and downs. And usually what I tell a patient is, it's a roller coaster ride, but as long as you're trending upward, that's the most important thing. And, you know, you have to have regular conversations. It's not a daily thing. It's a weekly to monthly thing, and they have to be on board, and they have to really follow the plan you write out for them. Because if they're not doing it, and they're doing all their activities that's putting stress on their spine, you're fighting a losing battle.
Yep, can't help somebody that doesn't want to help themselves.
Exactly, couldn't say better myself. So we went through a few of the common lumbar issues. Obviously, there is a litany of other problems that can cause low back pain, everything from referral pains to organ pains. There's so many things. We just went through some of the most common things that you will probably see in your clinic at some point. As always, if you guys want to know more, if there's anything you want us to go more in depth, I know I've gotten a few emails. We keep getting great feedback. Just let us know. We will probably work on getting some videos out to you guys. Just let us know what you want to see, what you want us to go more in depth on, and we'd be more than happy to start a little YouTube channel and go through some videos. But we need your feedback, because if not, we're just going to indulge in YouTube stuff, and you probably don't want to see much of that. That's just going to be us talking about sports and nothing relevant to PT. Right, Joe?
Yeah. Every once in a while, we might throw something relevant in there.
Sure.
But mostly thanks for listening, and keep sending us feedback. We love to hear it.
Absolutely. So we look forward to keeping it going. Leave your comments on iTunes, therapyinsiderspod.com. We love to hear from you, and thanks for listening.